This podcast is part of the Deluxe Edition Network. To find other great shows on the network, head over to deluxeeditionnetwork.com. That's deluxeeditionnetwork.com.
Here is a special message from Josh Scar of the Talking Smack podcast, who suggested this film for our listener request episode. The film is Steven Spielberg's Hook. As a kid, I remember loving Hook. It had everything you wanted in a movie: Robin Williams, adventure, superpowers, a good villain, and Steven Spielberg. Even at age 6, I knew who Spielberg was. Hook is a lot of fun, from Dustin Hoffman's Hook to Robin Williams showing off a wonderful range, from business dad to a literal man-child version of Peter Pan. The child actors are particularly strong. Dante Bosco as Rufio holds his own with a pro like Williams and plays off of Hoffman's Hook so well. I do understand that Neverland isn't as vibrant as one might want it to be, but based around the story being told, it feels like a nitpick. The reason why I submitted Hook as a look back at how Siskel and Ebert reviewed it is because of a scene in the Clerks animated series.
The defense now calls Steven Spielberg.
Your Honor, what is the point of this?
I agree.
Your Honor, you've also never been in a Spielberg movie.
I was in Gremlins.
But not Gremlins 2.
Hey, you're right. I'm going to allow it.
What was the deal with Hook? I want my $8 back.
If anything, Hook is a safe move that maybe doesn't live up to the prestige that Spielberg has become known for by the early 90s. But it's a strong family movie that goes beyond the typical Peter Pan story. It's good-natured fun that most everyone can sit down and walk away from, and it's a Spielberg specialty. Today on Back to the Balcony, Justin Henson of the Movie Wire and I will discuss Steven Spielberg's Hook. Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, two titans of cinematic review. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but always captivating. Your hosts Antonio of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast and Justin Henson of the Movie Wire are here to take you back to the balcony. Okay. I mean, we knew this day was coming. Josh Scar is a friend of ours, and we kind of know that Hook was not looked on very fondly by most critics of the day, but especially Siskel and Ebert. So this is going to be a very interesting conversation, because I, upon my rewatch over the last couple of days, wanted to feel more nostalgic for this movie. And the problem is, I never had nostalgia for it from the beginning. So maybe I was thinking, did Spielberg pull the shades over me like I think he was trying to with critics, where he could have the excuse of, well, if you don't like this movie, it's because you're no longer a kid at heart. And that's what the movie is about. And he's trying to subterfuge that point to make his subpar Spielberg film be more palatable, enjoyable, but mostly defendable. And I just couldn't get there, Justin. What do you feel about this movie?
So this one I did love as a kid. And to me, the rewatch is a little bit different. I haven't watched this in probably about 3-4 years. And with the intent going into this conversation, I did kind of have to put my critic's hat on, because this is one of those movies I never understood why critics hated it so much. And I see it. I see some elements to it, but that doesn't mean it's a horrible movie. It doesn't mean that it doesn't have elements. Did it deserve the critics' bashing of this movie? Absolutely not, because there is enough here with the intended audience is trying to do. So to me, I still love Hook. I still love the performances. I still love the production value of it. So to me, this one still rings nostalgia to me, because I remember when the trailer came on TV for the first time, and I pointed that out to my mom and say, I want to see this movie. And it's that shot of Jack with the blankets being shoved off with that green hue. And my mom told me, absolutely not. That looks absolutely frightening. Until I said it was Peter Pan and she says, let's go. And we saw it three times in the theater. So to me, this one does hold special to me. And I think a lot of kids that came out of Hook didn't hold Spielberg on a mantle. A lot of us didn't know who Spielberg was. So they can be engulfed into one, imagination, and two, enjoying this world as it was presented to us. So to me, I think a lot of kids grew up with this movie, liking it, and have, like Josh, that nostalgic flavor to it, because we didn't hold filmmakers to a standard back then. We just wanted to be entertained and have something memorable on screen and walk away from it. So, and I was part of that crowd.
Well, I'm not going to say that I was expecting anything out of Spielberg, but I knew who Spielberg was because I was raised on, I'd say, that trifecta of films of his during that early part of the 80s as I was coming up in the world. Jaws, E.T., and Indiana Jones. I count the trilogy as one because it's one character, three films. Temple of Dune is my favorite. I think I've said that before in the podcast. But yeah, so I was not going to say that I had an expectation as much as that I was excited to see the new Spielberg movie. Of course, I was excited to see Robin Williams, and I knew who Dustin Hoffman was. So that seemed very exciting to me. Where I think maybe my too mature of a cinematic brain for being 10, 11 years old at the time was, is number one, I had an insider who was on this film. So my uncle is an acrobat, and he was a stuntman for the film. And I remember him showing us Polaroids of him in like the Lost Boy gear and behind-the-scenes pictures of him being in the film. And he just knew it was a Peter Pan movie. He knew nothing more about that. He didn't know the script. He's like, yeah, I show up. I do acrobats. In fact, he's the guy who's on the trapeze for Rufio in the Rufio scene when he's flying around the set. So I had like a little bit of insider information, but also I've said this before, I had Entertainment Weekly delivered to our house since like 1986 until like the early 2000s. I almost learned how to read by Entertainment Weekly articles. And I vividly remember when they were talking about this movie is that it was a movie based from the point of view of Captain Hook, and it's called Hook. So I think that was my expectation. It's like, oh, we're going to watch a movie through the eyes of a villain. And in a way, that's kind of the way it's pitched in some of the earlier trailers. But then you watch this 2 hour and 20 minute long movie, and it's not that. Instead, it is this movie about Peter Pan losing his childhood, losing his memory, growing up and being some kind of yuppie lawyer. And as a kid, I couldn't identify with that. I was upset with how childish the Lost Boy seemed and how kid-friendly it was. And remember, around the same time, we had Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, which was 2 hours and 20 minutes long, but it didn't slog you with all this finding yourself rhetoric. It was an action romance drama all the way through. So of that particular year, that was the movie that got my rocks off. And this, I remember sitting in the theater with my parents. If I had a watch, I'd be checking it. Like, I just was not excited by this movie. So I've tried. I've literally tried for the last, 30 years to try and get on board with what people have love for this movie, and I just don't have it. That being said, I don't think it's a bad movie. It's an ambitious movie, to say the least. And that's what our critics say, too. It just doesn't speak to me the way it spoke to other people around my generation, our generation, and I just have never been able to break that.
It's funny you mentioned the runtime, because last night I did a second rewatch on it, and for the first time ever watching this movie, it was probably about 12:30, and I pause it, and it's 49 minutes left of it, and I thought to myself, what the hell happens in the next 49 minutes? What 49 am I missing? So it didn't even escape me how long this movie was, and I actually did check my clock last night. So, and that's when we come across where everything in kind of towards the second act just feels really rushed, thrown in, and that's where I think everything falls apart to an extent when it comes to the critics' eyes. But in fairness to Spielberg, he didn't even like this movie. He really didn't. And this one almost went through a creative production hell. We had writer Nick Castle that originally was at the helm at the director's seat, where they planned Tom Hanks and David Bowie as the Hook Pan character. Then Castle took over. We got Hoffman and Williams. So there was a lot of creative differences. There was one point where I think Hoskins and Hoffman thought Hook and it's me were a gay couple. So
I still feel that way and I still like it.
So to me, and I think that makes the chemistry work. I think they still went with that intention because it's a great chemistry. It just works. Mm-hmm. But to me, overall, it isn't a well-written movie. It's a forced emotion movie. It goes and at the end of the day, it's perfect for a December release for families. And even though Spielberg, I think I have a quote from him, I felt like a fish out of water making Hook. I didn't have confidence in the script. I had confidence in the first act and I had confidence in the epilogue. I didn't have confidence in the body of it. I didn't quite know what I was doing and I tried to paint over my insecurity with production value. The more insecure I felt about it, the bigger and more colorful the sets became. That's what we saw. And to an extent, I give him credit to, and I've said it before, is we compensate for the lack of dialogue, the lack of quality of dialogue, and we just, and even direction here, and just pump it full of colorful set designs and just CGI or claymation, whatever it may be, to get some entertainment value. So to an extent of me, on the creative level, it lacks, but we don't lack on the entertainment value here. And I think that's where the production value really tries to plug in some of those holes. And the chemistry between some of these characters really do their best with it. So I think when it comes to an overall feel for a December release, Spielberg does his best. Is it his best work? Absolutely not. But for a family film, it has every element that appeals to everybody of the family to give a little nugget to enjoy or walk out of that's at least memorable.
Boy, do I have a lot to say about everything you just said, because I agree with you. So I think where it comes from the critics' aspect is Spielberg made a kid movie that he knew that kids and families, for the most part, were going to enjoy. He had to like really swallow his pride and say, okay, critics are holding me to an expectation more than audiences are. And they did. And that's where that kind of comes into play. But also where this feels like is with Nick Castle being the original, you know, storyteller, the screenwriter before it got Hollywoodized, right? We're talking about a very interesting time of the late 80s, early 90s, where we have genre filmmakers all of a sudden being poached by big family studios to do movies like this. You know, so Castle, who's known for like being the writer of Escape from New York, The Boy Who Could Fly, and my personal favorite, The Last Starfighter, seeing those three movies that have very dark elements to them, even though a couple of them are technically family films, you can tell the direction he wanted to go with this. When you're thinking about how sinister Hook actually is, but also he's got inner demons and we're supposed to be interested in those. Once the studios get a hold of it and now it's Spielberg's, yeah, the writers, and there were a lot of ghost writers, including Carrie Fisher on this one, that did everything they could to make this more of a Hollywood movie, a family movie, and a movie that Robin Williams could star in that would make him more kid-friendly again. Because if we think about it, he didn't have a lot of family credits in the 80s. He was Good Morning Vietnam. He was Moscow on the Hudson. The year before this, he had done Fisher King. So he may have been very friendly for families on television, Mork and Mindy and all that, but he was still doing some pretty adult films in the 80s, and this was the one that kind of brought him into the family movie fold. I think about filmmakers like Stuart Gordon, right? B-movie, horror movie maestro. He's the guy that brought Honey, I Shrunk the Kids to Disney. And it was dark, and they turned it into what it is. Still like an action suspense film for kids, but they took all of the darkest elements, like kids dying or getting eaten by insects, out of it, right? I feel that this movie suffers from a lot of that. You see the shadows of a darker film in it, but then the Hollywood-produced big-budget part of it is so blatantly obvious, especially with a set design and especially with all of the kids and the youngster energy, but also trying to be hip and modern, but in this other world. We have skateboards. We've got street slang in the Never Never Land, which, if memory serves me correctly, these kids would have been here since like the 30s, 40s, 50s. When did all this modern day parlance come into play if Peter Pan's been gone since the 60s? That's me picking it apart. But again, my point was, you can tell that this was obviously a darker story that got glamorized and then Spielbergized. And he wasn't that guy anymore. He wasn't the E.T. director anymore. He wasn't the Jaws or Close Encounters anymore. At this point, he'd literally become a caricature of himself, and this is the movie that really proves that, where all he knows how to do now is make things big and bombastic and overproduced, but he has the hubris to recognize it and say it in print. So I don't blame him for it. I understand why he did it, which makes me understand why critics did have a hard time with it.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, to the credit, there are some fantastic Spielberg shots and touches to this that I really did appreciate. But you can tell, to your point, you're absolutely right. This was a darker tone originally, because you can always tell in just looking at the dialogue, our adult characters have more speaking lines than our children. The children have very limited lines. You have maybe just a couple that have more than two sentences spoken throughout the movie. So when you take kids out of the element and more focus more on the adults, you can tell, one, this was intended for a Hook point of view, and two, a darker tone. So there are things out there where this was supposed to be a musical with Michael Jackson as well. I mean, that kind of goes into the mix of just production and creativity clashes, right? But right. There is a lot of undertones here. And I think this is where ideas we really do see on a critic's point of view, it all these ideas clashing and Spielberg's throwing his hands up saying, let's just throw some shit on the screen and make it look pretty. I don't know what else to do with this, because everybody else is having an opinion. Studios are getting involved. So I think at this point, he has every right to be disappointed in this, because he doesn't really have control with how much creativity. This is a great character that's through our history with, what, 17 adaptions, 18 adaptions. So
right.
This one is a very important one, and our critics are going to speak to it of why not make just a live action Peter Pan, because it's been done over and over again. Even at that time, you have the musical version, you have the animated version, you had TV shows. So to me, I'm sick of Peter Pan, and this is the one, if you look at the remakes over history, this is the one that kind of stands out as something different. So there's an appreciation now, than even more so than what we had back then. So to me, I think over time, on originality, this one stands out as one of the better, dare I say, Peter Pan stories, because it tries to do something different.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me that this story just keeps on going, right? In like the last 20 years, we've had four or five big budget Hollywood produced Peter Pan films. You know, we had the Finding Neverland one, which was kind of like the backstory of how it got written. But then we had the Jason Isaacs as Captain Hook. Then we had the Garrett Hudlund one with Hugh Jackman in it too. And then we just had the Peter Pan and Wendy on Disney Plus. But nobody that I actually know personally gets excited about the Peter Pan story anymore. And if they are, it's either the original animated film or this film. So again, like, I'm not going to say this is a bad film. It's just not a film for me. So why? Okay, so I do have a problem with the runtime. I have a problem with the pacing. I have a problem with the dialogue. I have a problem with John Williams' score. Like, this might be my least favorite score of his. It doesn't feel like a John Williams score. And there's all that weird jaunty piano music in the first like 20, 30 minutes before they go to Neverland, where, you know, each character, especially the son, Jack, has like his own little piano riff. It doesn't feel like it matches the movie's tone. And that's just, you know, me thinking, that's my opinion. It's a very opinionated statement. But I think my biggest issue with the film is that Robin Williams and Dustin Hoffman don't work for me as these characters. They don't. Dustin Hoffman more than Robin Williams. I feel that Robin Williams does distract from the character by doing his Robin Williams-isms. I'm not saying it's a bad performance. It just doesn't really work for me. And then when he turns into Peter Pan, when he finally finds the pan again, it just seems so cliche and characterized that I don't really buy it. Dustin Hoffman is doing way too much work here. That's my opinion, is that instead of being a Hook that we like, I feel like he's trying to be overly sinister. But the whole point of his role in this movie is we need to understand why he is the way he is. And the person that helps him do that is Bob Hoskins. His Smee, to me, is the MVP of the movie. That is what I get excited for every time those scenes happen. his, even the scenes where he doesn't have dialogue, all of his action, all of his business that he's doing on screen, even in the background, is literally keeping me interested in those Captain Hook scenes. But other than that, I just don't think that Dustin Hoffman is understanding what this character is. I feel he's just trying to over methodize and overplay this role. Now, I dig the idea of Bowie because Bowie would have played it smarmy. Bowie would have played it with an air of sophistication. And I don't get that from Hoffman's performance. So these two leads, to me, just feel out of sync. That, I think, is my biggest issue, because I can forgive all the other business. I can forgive the kid stuff. I can forgive Julia Roberts' terrible performance as Tinkerbell because she's not in it a lot. It's the fact that the two people that I come to see in this movie aren't doing it for me. That's where I come from.
Man, you took me on a roller coaster of emotion right there, because you start talking about pacing and I'm on board, and then we started spouting fighting words. So I agree, right, though, but the pacing is off, and that's my biggest issue with it, is we get into where he figures out he's Peter Pan. It's like a light switch, because he has 3 days to figure this out. Why 3 days? I don't know. It was stupid. That's like a week's at minimum worth of work on a middle-aged man. I don't know. But the pacing...
Right. Tinkerbell's a terrible negotiator.
Yeah. But the pacing feels like it's 3 days, because everything seems like he's struggling, and then he just gets it. So I don't buy that, because when he figures it out, you have the kind of pointless romance between him and Tinkerbell that I didn't like. And everything just feels rushed at that point after going into the second act. But here's what I will say about the John Williams score. Let me ask you this. You didn't enjoy that score of the last climatic sword fight between the Lost Boys and Captain Hook with that cinematic score. To me, that is one of the main aspects that always goes over in my head as just a memorable scene because of the score, because it's the adventurous. And keep in mind, John Williams, under Spielberg, doesn't create it based on musical tone of his own liking. It's to match the tone of the movie. So to me, I think it did match, because it does have that element of a lot of high trebles and a lot of percussion that goes into the rumblings of that sword fight. So to me, I thought that was really good. But what about that scene?
That's where we differentiate our opinion, where let's say you have a wonderful sequence and the score is done great. Fantastic. But I think the real job of a composer is to make sure that you are telling the story through your music from beat one till closing credits. And Williams is the master at that. Maybe he's too good. So when he doesn't match what I'm looking for in a Williams score that can keep me engaged the entire movie, it disappoints me. But my opinion doesn't matter. I'm not a critic. That's just how I feel, right? Like, I'm not saying it's a shit score. I'm saying, like, dude, Jaws, perfect example. From beat one, from that opening scene till the very last frame, you are engaged with the music as much as you're engaged with what the screen is showing you. I don't get that with this. Yeah, there's great moments of music in the movie, but it doesn't feel complete. It feels segmented. And that's probably my biggest complaint of a composer when, for example, Titanic, right? Titanic is one of those movies where it's so long and there's so much going on that they just use variations of the same theme throughout the whole movie, that by the end of the movie, you're tired of it. That's how I feel about Titanic. Other people love it, but that's just how I feel. Where Williams, yeah, you're going to have the Indiana Jones theme. You're going to have the Star Wars theme and the Jaws theme. What matters to me is all of the music that you play in between your big moments that keep you engaged with the movie and the characters. And I didn't feel it in this one, especially with our non-titled characters. If it's not Captain Hook, if it's not Peter Pan, I feel like the music is just kind of lackadaisical. And that's just me, once again.
Yeah, I see it. To me, I think it's just underutilized, if anything, because I do enjoy, that's one of my favorite aspects of the movie. But Dustin Hoffman... Here's my take on Dustin Hoffman. I'm done with the the sophisticated Hook. I'm done with the sophisticated villain. I get it. We want the villain to feel threatening. We want him to feel sinister. This is, I think, Dustin Hoffman playing the in-between between animation and the cynical, because I think what the main intent of his portrayal, and we see it based on the dialogue, we see that scene of him gaslighting Jack. We don't understand why. We don't get an explanation. That's part of the problems with the movie. But we see that gaslighting scene. We see him manipulating, and that's him. He's using his just his overall manipulation versus his, I don't know, his politeness, I would say, or whatever it may be. But to me, I think this one is a gaslighting Captain Hook that just plays with your mind. You want to love to hate him. And that, I think, he teeters on a very fine level, because he's really engaging to me to watch on screen on what he's going to say next. Not what he's going to do, but what he's going to say next. Is he going to be kind of the likable villain, or is he going to be kind of that asshole that really is going to manipulate a child or manipulate Peter Pan? What is the Hook we're going to get in this next scene? And the scene we get from that baseball game, that's the example I would give, because I remember this scene and I still feel it today, is I don't know what Hook I'm going to get here. And it kind of almost to a borderline terrifies me. Is he going to be nice, or is he going to be supportive? What Hook are we going to get? Manipulation can be just as a fear as a hook on the hand. And that's what we see from his portrayal here. And to me, that I think Dustin Hoffman does a fantastic job with that. Whether or not the chemistry between Pan and Hook, I agree. That's kind of missing, because there's not enough screen time to really make that determination if it works. On the screen time that they have, there's not enough there to determine a chemistry. So I think that is underutilized when it comes to it. So I think we should have had a more in-between scene in that to really sprout that chemistry. But between the two, when they're on screen, I would agree to an extent that it's not there.
Well, and the thing that also bothers me too is we're dealing with very different energies between what Hook and the Pirates are doing and then what Pan, Tinkerbell, and the Lost Boys are doing, where one is there's a lot of, I'm going to say, almost Python-esque, Monty Python-esque cynicism to the Pirates, and that's what I want to spend more time with. But then when we go back to the Lost Boy Village, I'm just exhausted. I'm exhausted by the energy. I'm exhausted by the forced cuteness and imagination. And I get it. It's a kids movie. The problem is when you bring these two energies together, it's chaos. And it doesn't seem like controlled chaos. It seems like Spielberg doesn't know how to handle this situation. So he just shoots everything and they fix it in post. You feel it. You feel it in the energy of that moment. So that is another reason why I think that those performances get muted, because they're muted by the chaotic energy on screen. I think the best scene in the movie is the scene with Dustin Hoffman and Bob Hoskins when he's about to shoot himself. And he's like, Smee, stop me, stop me, get off your ass and stop me. Like, that, I think, is the shadow of what the project was before, but we only get that taste of it. We only get that taste of the darkness of these people, and then it turns back into fantasy. It's a really, 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 really thin line to walk, and I get why Spielberg was so frustrated by the process. He didn't really make a big kid film after this because he was so broken by it. He has kids in his movies, how can he not? But that many kids with that big of an expectation of being a kid movie, I can see where it did kind of break him and humble him. So I'm not saying Hoffman's bad. I'm just saying it's not what I wanted. And that's kind of like the beauty of subjectivity when it comes to a licensed property like this, is we all have our own interpretations of what a character should be. We've all got our favorite Batman. We've all got our favorite Alfred. We've all got our favorite whatever. This just doesn't work for me. In fact, I'm not sure if there's been any cinematic representation apart from the animated film that does work for me, but that's my problem. That's not your problem. So I think at the end of the day, my closing statement on this is, I'm not going to say Hook is a bad film. Does it deserve the hate it gets from critics? Again, that's critic subjectivity, but the proof is in the numbers. If you look on Rotten Tomatoes, it's got like a 20-something percent from critics, but it's a high 60s, low 70s, I think, from audience scores. Audiences do love this movie. Critics didn't. And at the end of the day, I'm not going to say the audience score is right, but they're the ones paying the ticket money. It's not the critics. So I think that is the proof for longevity and the nostalgia and the people that love it, like you and Josh Scar.
It's impossible to have 100% agreement on a movie. I mean, if you can cherry pick a couple things out of the movie and you can take away and it's memorable, that's a win in any movie, I would say. But this is one of those that, you know what, we'll have a question mark to the end of my time on the hate that it got. I don't know. That's just me. But again, everybody has their own taste. Some people just hate the story of Peter Pan. I get it. But yeah, this one, I think, was underappreciated at the time.
I'll give you that with a little caveat at the end. Hey, coffee lovers, Antonio and Justin of Back to the Balcony here, and we've got something special for you. If you're looking to start your day with the perfect boost, you need to try Bulletproof Coffee. This isn't your average cup of joe. It's packed with high-quality ingredients designed to fuel your body and mind. Whether you're powering through a workout, tackling a busy workday, or just need the extra edge, Bulletproof Coffee has got you covered. And guess what? We've teamed up with Bulletproof to give you an exclusive deal. Use code B2B, that's B the number 2B, at checkout to save 20% on your order. That's right, 20% off just for being a loyal listener. So don't wait, head over to Bulletproof's website and experience the difference yourself. Your mornings will never be the same with Bulletproof Coffee. Thank you for listening, and now back to the show. So we both know that our critics didn't like this movie. I have a lot of sound bites because they did go into very deep discussion about what didn't work. And before we even get into this, you can tell that this is a movie that they walked into wanting to enjoy. And we've seen this before. When they have high expectations for a movie and it doesn't deliver, then the criticism is even doubly acidic. And this is a perfect example of it. So Gene starts off.
Steven Spielberg's Hook has aged and turned into a work-obsessed yuppie. He's the kind of high-tech guy who sends an employee to tape his kid's little league game, and the kid gets ticked off. That's a very cute setup to the picture, but the film starts to fall apart as Peter is about to go off to Never Never Land to recapture his youth and recapture his children taken by Captain Hook.
Okay, so I like how he said that, where the beginning is the most interesting part, and I kind of agree, because when you're a kid, the beginning is boring because you just want to get to Neverland. You want to get to all the fantasy elements of it. What I recognized in this viewing, because it's been at least a decade or more since I've seen it last, is being a busy adult and, you know, sometimes not having as much time with the kids as I want, I really started empathizing with the mom and with Aunt or Grandma Wendy and with the kids, because we see what the dad is doing. This is from the hustle and bustle professional era of the 80s and 90s, where it's like your job is literally more important than your family. I was more engaged with that element of the movie than I was with the fantasy part. But that's not how it was when I was a kid. I remember just wanting to get through all this shit to get to Neverland. And this watch, man, I was like, I really don't want to get to Neverland. I want to hear more conversations between Peter and his wife and about what they're going to do and how he needs to like straighten his life up. And yes, I know becoming Peter Pan is what's going to do that, but I was almost dreading Tinkerbell showing up. That's where I was on this watch.
Well, we look also at the anticipation. I mean, during the first couple of watches, I'm sure we're anticipating seeing Peter Pan. We're anticipating what we're about to see. So the enjoyable moments back then, I'm sure even with Siskel, the anticipation of what Spielberg's going to bring to the table really kind of kept us on edge on what the movie was going to present. So that's that. But we also look at the great chemistry that we have, that the conflict feels real. We feel the actual family conflict, and we see this awkwardness when Robin Williams and his family go to Wendy's house. There's a certain edge to it. And I think that's what was really missing in a lot of the dialogue going forward with it. So I think Siskel is right. The first act is really enjoyable because there's anticipation and there's chemistry. There's some bite to it.
Well, it reminds me of Close Encounters of the Third Kind, right? Like there's an obsession element to it, like Richard Dreyfuss has with the visions he's having, right? And the family doesn't understand it. It's almost like you're watching Spielberg trying to play the hits all in one movie, right? You've got this obsessed dad and he's playing the hits from Close Encounters and that dynamic. And then we get to the fantasy land, he's playing the hits from E.T., he's playing the hits from the Kick the Can episode of the Twilight Zone movie. Like, he's really kind of playing his playlist. But they go on.
Before he goes off, Tinkerbell, Julia Roberts, pays him a visit and notices the aging process. She doesn't have any good scenes in this picture. She's too small to be appreciated most of the...
Okay, so we got to go back to that. She doesn't have any good scenes in this picture, 100%. Is that the writer's fault or is that Julia Roberts' fault? I'm sorry, man. I cannot stand Julia Roberts in this movie. It makes no sense why she got cast. She's not funny. She's not cute. She almost feels like she is a paid-to-play actor. She is not putting anything into it. I get it. This is probably early green screen technology. She's not acting against any actor. She's in a studio by herself. These days, actors know to have that in their repertoire, right? They know that they're going to be doing a lot of scenes, picked up, ADR, green screen. They're going to put you in later, fix it in post. But this is still a very practical effects era of cinema. So maybe that is why she is delivering the most dead behind the eyes performance I've ever seen her do. She's a good actress. I like her in almost everything. Even if the movie's terrible, I like her. But I cannot stand her in this movie, man. Is that just me?
No, it's not you. And since she won a Razzie Award this year for her performance, I don't think it was just us either.
Right.
But I'm not going to blame, per se, all the blame on Julia Roberts, because then we go back to the written dialogue. What she does have she has limited scenes, but she has limited dialogue. There's no majestic dialogue here for a fairy. There's nothing that they're creating. There's no creativity to what she's saying. It's just her taking the simplistic dialogue, dancing around the screen, being Julia Roberts. So to me, I think it's a 50-50 share. When she performs this dialogue, there's nothing really about it. That's why that one scene where they had that romance really drove me nuts, because I didn't really want to see it. And it kind of just distracts the movie, because it's not earned. And that's because of the writing, and that's because of the performance. We don't need to hear more of her. We don't need to see more of her, because that whole character isn't earned throughout the movie. She's just a plot point to just move these characters along and this story along. So that's all she's doing. So I'm not a huge Julia Roberts fan. I think she's fine, but
she's
a movie star. I mean, she plays the same character over and over again. But to me, this one, I think it's hard for me to put blame on it, because I know the dialogue isn't there for her.
Also, it's like, she doesn't have to be in the movie. Like, have Tinkerbell be dead, right? Like, get him somewhere, get him to Neverland some different way. Have Tootle send him. I don't know.
You were rooting for Robin Williams not to clap in the beginning. Just leave her dead in that dollhouse.
Leave her dead in the dollhouse. Give her more poison. All right, they continue.
Dustin Hoffman isn't special as Captain Hook. There's little menace to his characterization. He's kidding with this performance, and we never believe, as a result, that Peter is in jeopardy.
Okay, this is the one that we're probably going to talk about the most, because I 150,000% agree with Gene on this one. And I never agree with Gene, but I agree with him on this one. I'm not going to say that it's a meaningless performance like he says. It's not meaningless. It doesn't feel right to me. And I don't have any other explanation than that's just not how the character works in my mind. So that means I'm walking in with a particular bias of what Captain Hook should be or could be, and Hoffman just doesn't do it for me. He doesn't. But then I thought about it too, man. Maybe there's just so much action around him that it kind of swallows what he is trying to do. Anytime that he's on the pirate ship, pirates are yelling and shouting, and there's music, and there's action, and there's business. How do you perform with all that going on and want the audience to really connect with you? Maybe that's what it is. You got Bob Hoskins essentially mugging and stealing every scene that you guys share together. If you are a method actor, and this is one of the things I've always had an issue with real method actors, is you're going into a scene with a very strict regiment of rules, of limitations of your performance, and a clear idea of what you want to do. If you're working with a powder keg as your scene partner, how are you going to respond? How are you going to act opposite of that? How are you going to match that energy? Well, you're going to have to either let the character take you there since you're so invested, or you're going to have to break character and pretty much go with the flow. And not many people do that. And that's my problem with his in this particular movie, is he stays monotone. He stays that particular character the entire time, and he lets other people literally trample over him with performance. Now, that could be Spielberg's fault for not controlling the scene and not controlling the actor. And we all know that Spielberg is more of a cinematic director than he is a personal performance director. We've seen him do it before. We've seen videos of him doing line readings for his characters just so they can match the energy of what the camera's doing. I'm not saying it's a wrong technique. It's just his technique, which is why his movies do look so good. But maybe Hoffman's just not that kind of actor to be in a Spielberg movie. You know, if he's going to play Hook that same way every shot with all those camera moves and all that action behind him, maybe that's why I feel his performance is so muted. And Jim's term saying like meaningless, nothing special, I get what he's saying because everything around him is so loud that it mutes out everything he's doing.
I'll agree that it's busy, but with my interpretation of the character, I think it's different. And going back to my point of kind of the manipulating Captain Hook, I think it's different enough. I think culture has set that expectation of what Captain Hook should be. And we have that going into movies where we have this expectation that this is the hook we're going to get. And even though we don't want to see the same thing, we're expecting the same thing and we demand the same thing.
Right.
And I think that's what Gene was really kind of hoping for. When it comes to his, to me, I think this is almost a brilliant role for Dustin Hoffman, because this is a different kind of Dustin Hoffman that really challenges him a little bit. Because at this time we had Rain Man, we had a lot of these serious roles from the 70s and 80s that really challenged his career, that he was very particular on the scripts that he picked to really get him that serious actor. And then we have this that separates him a little bit differently, that he knows he has to kind of give a little bit more family-friendly goofiness to it, but still a threat. And that's why, I mean, to me, I appreciate the performance a little bit more on the portrayal, because he does kind of meet in the middle when it comes to giving us something different, something manipulative, and something that is almost a mental threat versus a physical threat. So to me, I think it was a good portrayal.
Okay, so my retort to that is 1990, the year before this, we have a very similar film in the terms of the size of production and the amount of talent in it. And that's Dick Tracy. What Pacino did with Big Boy Caprice in Dick Tracy goes to show that a method actor can bring a bombastic performance to a big production film and know the assignment, understand the assignment, and be able to deliver a performance that's not going to get muted out by all of the production. That's my point with Hoffman in this. I get what you're saying. You love that gaslighting scene, but I'm not going to let one scene that he really does it well compensate for the rest of the movie where he lets himself literally just get trampled over by performance and by spectacle. I think that's the point that I've been trying to make this whole time. But again, I really don't blame him, because he should have been directed better. You know, I almost feel that Spielberg was intimidated by him and was like, okay, this is what you want to do? Just do it. I'm going to focus on all these crazy bastards swinging from ropes and all this money we've gotten, pirate ships and Lost Boys and acrobats. You do you, Dustin. That's what it feels like to me. And that's why I just feel like, personally, that energy doesn't match.
Well, there could be truth to that, because there's a rhyme and reason early Spielberg chooses some new talent coming into his movies, because right. It's a comfort level.
And uses them over and over again. Yeah.
Correct. So there is a rhyme and reason. But I will go to the grave on my Dustin Hoffman
you
defense.
Can't, man. I don't hate you for it. It's just like, and I'll go to the grave where like, this might be my least favorite Dustin Hoffman performance. My least favorite Dustin Hoffman performance is Mad City with John Travolta, but this doesn't really fall too far away from it. Okay, so they keep going.
There is a little magic later on when Peter returns from his adventures, but it's too little, too late. Steven Spielberg, I'm afraid, may have grown up himself, because in this picture, I think he's so much better portraying adults now than he is kids. A surprising thumbs down, at least surprising to me, based on my expectations for this picture, on Hook.
Okay, so again, I agree with him. Like, we've already said this. This does feel like Spielberg is trying to play the hits, and he's not trying to impress anybody anymore, right? He came out of the gates firing Sugarland Express and Duel and Jaws and Close Encounters into Indiana Jones, man. Like, you can't top that coming into your own in Hollywood. So we all know that sustainability is the most challenging part of a successful director. I've said this for so long, is that to me, success isn't like how great your films are or how much money they've made. True success is sustainability. How long can you stay in the game? How long is your name still worth a damn at the box office or on video cassette, you know, where people start talking about you as the old has-been, and you can tell that he's never wanted to be that guy, which is why I think sometimes he rushes productions out way too quick just so he can stay relevant. You know, I feel like for the last 15 years, we know that we're going to get two or three mediocre Spielbergs and then a banger one, because he just wants to stay in the game. He wants to keep creating. He wants to stay relevant. There's nothing wrong with that. I honestly think that this film is the start of that cycle where he's like, I got to make this big. I got to make this work. Because before that, he had Always, which was fine, you know, but he wasn't able to capture that 80s magic, and this was the one that he really wanted to capture it with.
Well, there's a rhyme and reason why he goes into period pieces now, and that's his kind of his forte that he sticks with. That me, personally, I'm sick of those type of movies. Same. From Spielberg. But yeah, I mean, to an extent, and at this time with... I hate to keep defending it because I know it's a mute point, and I don't want to give excuses for him, because I am a Spielberg fan on relevancy at the time. Mm-hmm. But... Birth of New Child, going into a production hell, going into creativity. This is a guy that took a job at the wrong time.
Good point.
Because he wasn't able to focus on his true passion. Spielberg is a humble guy because he admits it when he screwed up a movie. And he admitted it with this one. So to me, I think he wasn't able to be vested 100% in this. So he did what he knew what he could do with the time that he had, and that is with production value. And I'm going to get into that in probably in the next sound clip here coming soon. But to me, I think there's a lot of misses with this movie. And I'm not going to shy away from that, but I am going to recognize how hard it is making a movie, especially with a newborn child.
Yeah. And that part I did not know. So that is a good point. Let's go ahead. This next part is a long one. I might stop it in between, but this is when they really get into like the meat of this discourse.
I give a thumbs down too. You know, there's a truism in Hollywood that at some point executives start making movies that are really their own life story. And here what you have is a guy who's very successful, surrounded by big business,
right,
but is told that he has to recapture his youth in order to be successful. And that may be the way that Steven Spielberg feels, and it may be the reason he made this story, which is unbelievably cumbersome in terms of explaining why an adult Robin Williams has to go back and become Peter Pan again, and then how he comes back after he's been Peter Pan. It's so complicated that you really have to ask, why didn't Spielberg just make Peter Pan? Then everybody would have been happy.
You know, we interviewed him, I think it was a year and a half ago, and he had talked about a musical version of Peter Pan, and one thing this picture is really missing is music.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's an expectation that the audience has. Let me clarify what you're saying. You're saying that he needs a hit because his last couple pictures weren't big breakthroughs, and therefore, to be successful in some way, he has to go back and get that youthful quality that created E.T. and all
that. In a sense. And you know, another thing that I really felt was disappointing here was Neverland itself. That's the worst. It looks like a really crummy movie set, and the colors are even wrong. It's all red and brown. It ought to be green. It's green and blue and magical and sparkling from the air.
Okay.
And you get there, and it looks like they're in the middle of a drought, and it's all crowded with extras,
too many props,
too much money, and it doesn't look good.
To those people who have said, but those pictures have been made, the cartoon series and Mary Martin and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I would say they could have made a modern Peter Pan. Make the Lost Boys a bunch of trainees in his corporate department. In other words, make it all modern in some way. I think by trying to do, what's happening here corporate-wise is hedging of bets. We'll do one story for the adults, and then we'll get a kid show audience picture in the middle with Neverland, that part is a disaster.
It's pretty dreary.
Okay, so I don't agree with Gene at all about a modern take on Peter Pan. I think he's reaching there, but I appreciate what Roger is saying because it's literally how I feel. Like, I feel like this is three elements that he mentions. Number one, that executives in the studio really have turned this into an inner reflection of what their lives are, right? That's what it feels like. It's like, oh my God, Spielberg's making this Peter Pan movie about a guy who's now like a business guy and he doesn't have time for his family. That's my life. That's my life. It feels like there's a lot of producers and executives literally cramming more and more into this movie, and it feels like that. It's bloated. You know, all the rewrites and ghostwriters on it, that's usually the example. You hear it 1,000 times. It's like, okay, I brought this guy in to punch it up. Okay, well, I brought this guy in to punch it up. And before you know it, you don't have the movie that you started with. And how can you control that? You know, maybe Spielberg was powerful enough at the time, but maybe he was too exhausted to fight that. Number two, the idea that Spielberg was trying to compensate for lackluster reception of the last two movies, that to me seems the most relevant. Like, he literally threw every trick in his book, every play in his playbook at this movie. And you feel it. You feel a sense of desperation in the amount of people on this set, in the amount of construction this thing must have had, and then just, you know, the energy and cuts. I would have to go do my math. I'm going to say this is totally hyperbolic, but I think there are more edits and cuts in this movie than any other Spielberg movie. It is over-edited. It is overcut, 100%. I was like, oh my God, like, what is the average edit sequence in this movie? Like, what's the cut time? It feels like 3 or 5 seconds, and I'm getting a cut. I'm getting a cut. If it was an Oliver Stone movie, great, because I expect that. But not in a Spielberg movie. That's what it feels like to me. And then lastly, why are we making, I don't want him to make a Peter Pan movie. I wanted him to make a Captain Hook movie. The movie's called Goddamn Hook, and there's not enough hook. Maybe that's why I don't like the Dustin Hoffman performance, because it feels incomplete because there's not enough hook to make me feel connected to that character. I keep having to go back to the goddamn Lost Boys again, and I hate the Lost Boys, Justin. I hate them.
This is one of their reviews that did drive me nuts. And here's the deal. The corporate setting, bull, because you hated Scrooge. So right. that wouldn't work. So, but this is what Roger, not just Roger, but I'll say most critics, but more specifically Roger, because he calls it out here, the production design, the production value. This is where I would challenge, because on just a recent show, we questioned Gene Siskel on his James Woods Vampires Oscar nomination.
Right.
This movie was critically a bomb, and it got nominated for 4 Academy Awards. This one is where I think I'd have to do a little research, but a movie that is so bad critically, this has to be on the list of most Academy Awards nominated, even though, but let's look at it.
Are you talking about like cross comparison between like what had the most nominations, but then what had the lowest critic score?
Absolutely.
Interesting.
Because this one, best art direction, best costume design, best effects, best makeup, and for you, Antonio, best original song. By John Williams. Okay, but not score, I will give you that.
Yeah, the song. And I remember the Oscars, man. They got that little girl up in the bed suspended over the stage, and she sang that goddamn stupid song. I remember that.
It's a great song. It's not stupid. It's sweet. I love that song. And just to throw the nugget, Golden Globe nomination for Dustin Hoffman. But let's go back to the 4 nominations. The production value, they saw what Spielberg was doing. They saw how it translated to screen. So I know you're skeptical of awards, as you should be, but during this time, there was a lot of movies coming out during this time to fall into this category. There were some more critically acclaimed movies nominated here, but this one didn't win anything. But at the same time, it's sitting at a 29% critic score. and Roger calling it out, saying it looks absolutely horrible on screen, there has to be an element here where there has to be a give and take of when it comes to opinions, where this movie to me didn't look horrible. There are some great shots here. The mermaids in this the scene, the battle scene at the end, I loved. So there are lots of things I can pick out of this movie that's consistent with the overall tone. The Captain Hook and costume designs, Peter Pan, it's a Peter Pan costume, I don't really care. But the pirate costumes in unison are consistent, and it brings us into this world. Even though I agree with you on the point, it's busy, but at least it's consistent, and I get that feel that we are in this immense danger, especially when Robin Williams first gets to that ship. So to me, I think there are elements, and this is the critic review between both of them, that really shows a contradiction on what they really see in a movie. We praise Ninja Turtle sewer scenes. We praise Batman's noir set design, but we won't praise this. And this is what Spielberg admitted he put the most time and effort in, because he didn't know what he was doing in the story. So to me, I'm going to appreciate that, because this is what the movie intended to do, to give us a world and a spectacle during the holiday season at that time. And to me, it worked.
No, I agree with you in that. But at the same time, that is money. And you put money on a screen, you're probably going to get an Academy Award nomination for a production design. That's pretty much just common sense. However, there are these elements that I don't necessarily hate about this movie. Again, I don't hate this movie. I just don't like it. I'm not entertained by it, right? That's the best way to put it. Is this movie's not entertaining for me, but I'm not going to say it's bad, because it's not a bad movie. It's not a clunker. It's not a bomb. It's not Cutthroat Island, which has amazing production design, but is a shit movie. You know, it's not even a guilty pleasure for me. So it's just one of those things where I don't have to entertain it to not, I don't have to be entertained by it to not appreciate it. So I guess at the end of the day, my biggest thing for Roger and Gene and how much they didn't like it is, once again, it did not live up to their expectations, and that's why they're shitting on it, right? We know the audiences liked it. Critics didn't like it. I did not read any other reviews from any other critics except for these two, but I'm going to guess that they all play along the similar themes of, this doesn't feel like a Spielberg movie. How hard must that be to be Hollywood's golden boy for a decade and a half, and then opening up the 90s with a movie that critics just hate, and it's probably the one you spent the most money on and spent the most time on and had the biggest expectations for? You can tell by every movie he made after that, he's like, you know what? I'm not going to fuck around with that shit anymore. You know, I'm going to make Jurassic Park and Schindler's List, and I'm going to do them my way. I'm not going to do any of this studio tomfoolery. It's how I want to do it. I'm going to make my name, and he got it back. So maybe that's what the real importance of this movie is. It had to fail in those particular elements for him to really recognize what he needed to do to start this second wave of Spielberg films for the 90s, because he really did kind of own the 90s, and rightfully so, because Hook had to essentially sink for those to rise up.
I'm going to keep mine really simple. This movie failed at the wrong time for Spielberg to get involved in this. The script wasn't there, too many creative differences. So there was a cluster of things that could have gone wrong with this movie. But we've heard horror stories from Hollywood before, and I hate, and I always give people crap for using this. It could have been a lot worse, but this movie could have been a lot worse given all the challenges it faced. And I don't think it was as horrible to ruin Spielberg's career, but to seek him out, because there was a sense of wonder that we'll see 2 years from that date of release that we get a bigger picture from. So there's one thing that I will debate to my death, is Spielberg will never lose that sense of wonder in his early work. And we do see that shining through, at least through the production value, where he does put his heart and soul into it. And we can see that even though it's with money, we can still see that money well spent compared to some of the garbage we see today.
Agreed. And it was the right time, because it was still practical, right? If this was made 7 years later, it would all be terrible CG, and then we'd be shitting on it even more. So maybe this was kind of like the swan song of him saying goodbye to this world of practical effect and cinematic wonder, as he literally pioneered the CG world of effects into cinema. And good on him, because like I said, it's beautiful, but it's busy. I'm not a huge fan of it, but I'm not going to say it's a bad movie. All right. So when it comes to the reviews, here's my thing. This is where it gets really tricky, right? Because I agree with almost everything these guys say, but am I going to let my like objectivity to how I feel about the movie reflect on how I review them? Or is it the way they communicate it? That I think is the real challenge here. So for my critic, I agree with everything that he says, but I also feel that there is a strong sense of disappointment and bias from what he was expecting the film to be. Therefore, I think it loses a little bit of credibility, so I'm giving him a C on that. I agree with the message, but when it comes to the credibility of where he's coming from as a critic and his emotional connection to the expectation of what the movie's supposed to be, I think that clouds his judgment a little bit, and that's why I'm giving him a C.
Yeah, I can see that. And when it comes to Ebert, I think we get too mixed up into the Spielberg overall, his future projects or what he needs to do. I can care less about what the director is going to do. Tell me, you're broadcasting a critical review on TV to tell me if I should see it or not. So let me hear the review when he releases a new movie. So I think we lose a little bit there. And the one thing that stood out to me is the forte of the movie, which is the production design, the visual effects and all that. And we get that dogged. So I hate the woulda, coulda, shoulda concept of, yes, of critics. And that's what we saw a lot here. So to me, I didn't really get anything that really screamed, don't see this movie to an extent. But so to me, it's a little bit hard. But if I were to look at it at a critical aspect of it, I don't agree with 99% of the things he said on it. But the way he expressed it, he missed a lot of the topics that would convince me not to go see it. So I'm going to give him about a 1.5 star.
Okay. Yeah, you've been giving them some low scores lately. But you know what? I think that this is an era that they were starting to really feel who they were in the zeitgeist of cinema critique. Their show's more popular. They're more popular. They're now interviewing directors. They're now interviewing movie stars. This is the point, 1991, man, where people lived and died by the sword and by the pen of these two critics. So they were probably at like the apex of what cinema was supposed to be and whether or not there's going to get that thumbs up or that thumbs down. And you can tell in the way that they are more critical about movies in this particular era of their show. And I think this really reflects it. So it's a very fascinating conversation. Thank you, Josh Scar, for bringing this to the table. It might be our longest episode yet because there was so much to talk about. And again, I think the fun part about this movie is that I had zero investment in this film. So having someone else bring it to the list really got me motivated to put more into this episode.
I think we both knew it was coming, and I'm glad it came from Josh Scar. So it's a great recommendation. So I hope we get more and more of that coming in.
Yeah, absolutely. Please, everyone, send us your recommendations for films that were reviewed by Siskel and Ebert, because most of them aren't on our lists, and it gives us a chance to revisit them with, again, that non-biased point of view. So next week, we're going back into our picks. So the last pick was from Justin. It was Mermaids. And my pick for next week is Brian De Palma's absolute box office disaster, Bonfire of the Vanities. So let's see if it registers different for me as a 43-year-old man.
It's been a decade for me, so it's going to be a good revisit. So I am actually curious how I'm going to react to it now. So it should be a great conversation.
Awesome. Excited for it. So everyone, you know what to do. Find us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, and on X/Twitter under Back to the Balcony. You can reach out to me personally under The Cultworthy at thecultworthy.com and The Cultworthy Studios on Instagram. Justin, where can people find you?
You can find me on any of the socials at MovieWire Show, and you can visit my website at themoviewire.com.
Please like, review, subscribe, 5 stars, share with your friends, let people know about the show. And if you want to send a recommendation, send it to those socials. Justin, it was a great conversation. I'll see you next week.
See you next week.